Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Mario Ritter, Pete Musto, and Anne Ball. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will have the next part in our series on America's presidents. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
Business leaders are reacting to a new trade deal between the United States and China. The deal includes initial agreements on agricultural trade, financial services, investment, and energy. Some observers say the agreements do little to help the United States and fail to deal with issues concerning the Chinese market. But others say the trade deal is evidence of progress. The deal is part of the 100-day plan announced after a meeting between the Chinese and U.S. presidents last month. The plan opens up Chinese markets mostly for finance industries and industries based on commodities such as mining and agriculture. Robert Atkinson is president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. He said the trade deal fails to identify issues facing advanced industries that are important to America's economic future. In a statement, Atkinson said the deal gives China the ability to use its massive foreign reserves to buy up American companies in advanced industries. He urged the administration of President Donald Trump to stop thinking mainly about the U.S. trade deficit with China. Atkinson wants U.S. officials instead to consider two-way trade and demand real changes in Chinese policies toward American knowledge and technology-based industries. Derek Scissors is with the American Enterprise Institute, a public policy research group in Washington. He said the trade deal means almost nothing since China has promised to reduce restrictions on American businesses before. Scissors does not think that the U.S. trade deficit with China will be reduced this year. He urged the Trump administration to pressure China to reduce the amount of money it gives to state-owned companies. He noted, if that happens, foreign businesses will be able to capture a larger share of the Chinese market. Scissors also wants the administration to work on reducing Chinese involvement in the theft of intellectual property. He said the United States should threaten action against China as a way to cut down on the illegal copying of American products. Christopher Balding is a professor with the Peking University HSBC Business School. He said the deal between China and the United States is not a major agreement, but he thinks it is a step forward for the Trump administration. Balding told VOA that China has used what others have called a delay and diversion policy and has waited for years to do what it promises to do. He said some of the promises were made when China became a member of the World Trade Organization in 2000. Balding said the United States does not have the ability to force China to open its market. But he said China appears to react to the messages written by Trump on the social networking website Twitter. He said those tweets may give the U.S. some untraditional influence in pushing China. C.Y. Huang is a partner at the financial services company FCC Partners. He said it is important for American companies to demand full access to the Chinese market. But he warned that the Americans are being beaten by their fast-growing Chinese competitors. China is no longer afraid of opening up its market and competition from the United States, Huang told VOA. The Trump administration says the trade deal is a major one. U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said China will open its market to American beef exports by the middle of July. At the same time, the United States will begin to permit imports of cooked poultry from China. China will also let American-owned companies working in the country provide credit rating and electronic payment services. China's UnionPay already controls much of the electronic payment services in the country. Ross said the trade deal will help to reduce the U.S. trade deficit with China, which reached $347 billion last year. This is more than has been done in the whole history of U.S.-China relations on trade, Ross told reporters at the White House. He said the deal will go a long way towards reducing the trade deficit. I'm Mario Ritter.
Traditional Korean paper called hanji was once famous across Asia for its strength and ability to be used for multiple purposes. Now, only a small number of rural paper factories produce hanji. But Korean-American artist Amy Lee is dedicated to continuing the 2,000-year-old tradition through her artwork and teaching. And some of the artwork she creates using the paper can be worn as clothing, she says.
The very first dress that I made out of hanji was a Western dress, but as I was making more dresses, I thought, just in the way that I had explored Korean paper, I thought it would be wonderful to explore Korean dress.
The dress and Lee's other artwork created with traditional Korean paper are part of a group exhibition. It is being shown during the month of May at the Korean Cultural Center in Washington, D.C. The exhibition marks the celebration of Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. Jean Drews is the Chief of Binding and Collections Care at the Library of Congress. She says the exhibition shows how similar paper and cloth can be, and how either material can fit the same purpose.
Delicacy and strength is what I've found in Korean paper. That comes out in this exhibit. This exhibit is so wonderful.
Amy Lee was born in New York. Her dedication to Hanji started when she traveled to Korea in 2008 with a U.S. Fulbright grant to research disappearing traditional paper arts. She studied at a paper factory in a rural village run by the same family for four generations. The head of the family holds the special position of Korean National Intangible Cultural Property Holder of Hanji Making. The holders of these positions are considered masters of the arts. On her return, Lee opened a studio to teach the making of Hanji at the Morgan Conservatory, a nonprofit arts center in Cleveland, Ohio. Each fall, Lee says she collects material from the mulberry trees in its garden for use in the traditional papermaking process.
I gather plant material from outside, and then I have to go through the process of sorting the parts that you need and then cooking it in special solutions and then beating it and then making paper and then making art from that.
Lee has brought her Hanji papermaking classes to art museums and universities across the U.S. More of her students, Lee says, are not ethnic Koreans. They want to learn more about the culture. Lee's artwork includes both traditional and more modern paper objects. Her love for the paper has also led to her writing a book called Hanji Unfurled, One Journey into Korean Papermaking. And she says she plans to continue making Hanji for as long as she can.
I still feel like there's so much I can do and learn, and so I continue to use it, and I don't really see an end in sight.
I'm Pete Musto.
About 110 million years ago, a large plant-eating dinosaur covered with sharp points walked the land. Called a nodosaur, it is now the best example of its kind ever found. This new species of dinosaur is being called a one-in-a-billion discovery. Recently, it was put on display at Canada's Royal Tyrrell Museum in Drumheller, Alberta. The museum worked with the U.S. National Geographic Society to research the nodosaur. The National Geographic magazine June issue featured the dinosaur. This is an incredibly unique specimen, says Caleb Brown, the museum's lead researcher on the nodosaur. He says it is so well preserved with skin and armor, and it is three-dimensional. That means it was not flattened after it died.
It's the closest thing that you'll ever get to looking at a living dinosaur. if you're really lucky, you'll have small bits of skin preserved. And you really have to use your imagination to figure out what they would have looked like in life. In this case, you don't need a lot of imagination. What you see in front of you is what the animal looked like while it was alive.
Researcher Mark Mitchell spent 5.5 years, about 7,000 hours, carefully uncovering the nodosaur from the rock around it. Looking at its head, one can see where the eye once was. Brown says the animal looks like it has some personality.
When you're looking at it, it looks like it's looking back at you. And that's because that's how well preserved it is, even though the eye is not preserved anymore.
But it has been a long time since this animal was alive. It lived in the Cretaceous period, when dinosaurs ruled the world. At that time, the cold place where it was found in Canada was more like Florida today, warm and humid, and probably close to water. Scientists think it was swept out to sea and was buried in one piece in the soft, muddy bottom. It was covered in sediment that later turned into stone. Over time, it was covered by more layers and lay undisturbed until March 21st, 2011. That was when Sean Funk was working at a mine in Fort McMurray, Alberta. His machine hit something much harder and colored differently than the rock around it. There were black, brown, and orange pieces. Funk had found the fossilized remains of the nodosaur, a creature that was 5.5 meters long and weighed almost 1,400 kilograms. The orange pieces were part of the bony armor that protected the animal from attack. Researchers were only able to recover part of the creature, from the nose to the hips. So, what do scientists know about the nodosaur?
This was not an intelligent animal. It would be kind of a slow, lumbering beast, heavily armored and probably had slow reaction time.
The nodosaur, Brown says, was covered in armor to protect it from attackers. It had 2 half-a-meter long spikes or sharp pieces coming out from its shoulders. It was wide and had short legs, which made it low to the ground.
So you have to kind of imagine a spiny four-legged tank, and that's basically what this animal was. It would walk around on the landscape. It was an herbivore, so it would have been eating plants. It didn't do a lot of chewing. The teeth weren't overly efficient.
That means the creature processed much of its food in its stomach, just like cows do today. Inside the nodosaur's stomach, there were different colored, small-sized balls. Researchers think these are what the animal was eating when it died. They will study their chemical and light properties to find out what they are. They do not know if it was male or female. They think it was an adult, but they do not know how old it was when it died. If it made a sound, they do not know what it would have been. While chemical studies were done on the nodosaur, the results have not been made public yet. Brown says that will happen soon when their study is published. Meanwhile, people have been reacting to the pictures. Brown says Some have been emotional. They cannot believe they are finally seeing this very real dinosaur. I'm Ann Ball.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Franklin Pierce, the 14th President of the United States. He took office in 1853 at age 48. At that time, he was the youngest person elected to the White House. Pierce was known for being social and for his good looks. But his personal life was full of tragedy, and he was not an effective chief executive. Over time, he has come to be remembered as one of the country's worst presidents. Franklin Pierce was born in the northern state of New Hampshire. He was one of eight children. He attended school regularly as a child, and he went on to Bowdoin College in Maine. There, he developed his skills as an excellent public speaker. He also became an able lawyer. Pierce's abilities carried him far. But his personal connections helped, too. His father became the governor of New Hampshire. Shortly after, Pierce was elected to the state legislature. He soon became a member of the U.S. Congress, first as a member of the House of Representatives, and then as a senator. Several important things happened in Pierce's personal life during those years in Washington, D.C. He married Jane Means Appleton. They soon had a son, but the child died after only 3 days. The couple went on to have two more boys. In Washington, Franklin Pierce also developed friendships with many people from the South. They defended the right of states to permit slavery. Although he was from the North, Pierce came to share the opinions of his Southern friends. He grew to dislike anti-slavery activists, who were known as abolitionists. As a politician, Pierce was a member of the Democratic Party and strongly supported the ideas of President Andrew Jackson. But politics did not appeal to his wife. She also did not like her husband's habit of drinking alcohol with his friends. Jane Pierce belonged to the temperance movement, which urged Americans to avoid the use of alcoholic drinks. So Pierce resigned his job in the Senate and moved back to New Hampshire. There, he stopped drinking alcohol and earned fame as a lawyer and public speaker. But tragedy struck again. His second son became sick and died. Pierce remained active in politics in New Hampshire. He helped the Democratic candidate for president at the time, James K. Polk, win votes in the state. When Polk entered the White House, he gave Pierce a position as a general in the Mexican-American War. Pierce did not earn the respect of his troops. In one battle, he passed out after he fell off his horse and crushed his leg. Some of his men, seeing what happened, fled the battlefield. Others called him Fainting Frank. Although Pierce had his critics, he returned to New Hampshire as a leader in the state's Democratic Party. Yet no one expected him to become President of the United States. Pierce's nomination came during the Democratic National Convention in 1852. Party leaders could not agree on a candidate. They were split among the three top choices. So the party turned to Pierce. They liked the fact that he was not well known or had taken any strong positions as a lawmaker. As a result, fewer people could object to him, they reasoned. Pierce did very little during the election campaign. He did not need to. Many voters, especially in the South, did not like his opponent. When the election was held, Pierce won easily. But before he took office, another terrible thing happened. Franklin and Jane Pierce were traveling by train with their youngest son, Benjamin, who was 11 years old. The train went off the rails. Benny was killed instantly in front of his parents. Neither Franklin nor Jane Pierce ever really recovered. Jane believed their son's death was a punishment from God for her husband becoming president. As president, Pierce faced an extremely difficult situation. The country's ongoing dispute about whether and where to permit slavery was becoming more intense. Under Pierce, the dispute centered on the areas of Kansas and Nebraska. At the time, both areas were considered territories, not states. And each territory was above the line of the Missouri Compromise of 1820. That act, approved by lawmakers nearly 35 years before Pierce took office, banned slavery in northern areas, including what would become Kansas and Nebraska. But pro-slavery settlers demanded that Kansas and Nebraska voters, a group comprised of white men, decide the issue for themselves. A majority of U.S. lawmakers agreed. Under pressure, President Pierce signed the Kansas-Nebraska Act in 1854. The measure was one of the most important in U.S. history. It overturned the Missouri Compromise and canceled the ban on slavery. It incited years of intense violence between pro-slavery and anti-slavery activists, and it pushed a divided nation even further apart. The Troubles also showed Pierce to be an ineffective president. He could not ease the tensions over slavery nor unite the country behind the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And he delayed using his power to stop the violence in Kansas until it was far too late. Finally, his sympathy for pro-slavery groups angered many in the North, including people in his own party. The Democrats did not nominate him again at the next election. After 4 years as president, Pierce returned to New Hampshire. He rarely socialized and began drinking alcohol again. After his wife died in 1863, Pierce seemed to disappear from public life. Americans heard little about him until his death in 1869. But he lived to see the ultimate tragedy of the Civil War, that he, like other presidents before him, had failed to prevent. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.